Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Tax nerds rejoiced a little this weekend when a bold statement by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got Americans thinking, even if it was just for a little, about marginal tax rates. On 60 Minutes, Ocasio-Cortez told Anderson Cooper she wants a 70% marginal tax rate on the nation's highest earners. It would pay for a so-called Green New Deal, she said. Of course, in the reactionary and context-flattening parlance of modern American politics, the idea was met with everything from condemnation to derision, something Cooper seemed to anticipate when he asked Ocasio-Cortez this.
Do you call yourself a radical?
Yeah, you know, if that's what radical means, call me a radical.
Well, it may be radical, but the real question is it realistic? Can boosting top tax rates generate enough revenue to fund progressives' big ideas? Or is the tax the rich call a distraction from the cold fiscal realities of how to pay for ideas designed to transform the economy? So this hour on Point, taxes, mathematical realities, and big democratic dreams. And you can join us. What do you make of this idea? Should the super wealthy in America pay more in order to help fund economy-transforming ideas? Or does the trickle-down theory work better to benefit society in the long run? If we tax the super-rich, are we taking the energy out of the American economy? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today first in the studio is Peter Diamond. He is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In 2010, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics. He was also nominated by President Obama for the Federal Reserve Board. Peter Diamond, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us today from Alexandria, Virginia, is Brian Riedel. He's Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, where he focuses on tax and economic policies. He has a new piece out today for the National Review, headlined, Why 70% tax rates cannot finance socialism. There's a link to it at onpointradio.org. Brian Riedel, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Great to have you both. Peter Diamond, let me start with you here because none other than Paul Krugman in the New York Times recently cited your research in particular about why he thought that a 70% marginal tax rate wasn't a terrible idea. Here's what Krugman said. He says, the controversy of the moment of this 70 to 80% tax rate is obviously crazy, right? And he says, I mean, who thinks that makes sense? Only ignorant people like Peter Diamond, Nobel laureate in economics and arguably the world's leading expert on public finance. So is Paul Krugman accurately representing your view on what the top tax rates should be?
Yes.
He is. So tell me more.
Well, I want to start, actually, I'll throw you off what your plan was. We have had a severe shortage of investment in the future of this country for decades. It shows up in infrastructure, which we all complain about. It shows up in finance for basic research, which is so important for the economy. It shows up in the lack of evolution in our financing education when education becomes more and more important. We've got a real investment shortfall, mm-hmm. and we've had it for decades. That is a mistake for the growth of the country. In order to address that, we need more revenue. Would raising the tax rate, and let me be clear, the work that Paul was citing with Emmanuel Saez of Berkeley talks about the marginal rate reflecting all of the taxes. So 70% is not the federal income tax rate, but you take the federal income tax rate plus the Medicare supplement plus state and local taxes, and that should be 73% was the number Paul cited.
Okay.
And what do you knock off for those other things? Well, they're not very big. You knock off 4 or 5 percentage points.
But just to be clear, you're talking about a 73% marginal tax rate when taken in – marginal, though, when taken into account all taxes that,
yes.
that people pay.
Okay. That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now, that will raise a lot of money that we could address some of our shortfalls, and that will help us prepare for the large costs coming from climate change. By itself, is it enough to do what I envision this country needs? No, we're going to need more than that. But that is the right place to start.
Okay. So, Brian Riedel, I'm going to come to you in just a second here. But Peter Diamond, how much money do you think that 70%+ marginal rate, again, to take your point, on all taxes that the super wealthy might pay, how much would that revenue would that raise?
I don't have an exact number for you. I saw a bunch of sites in the press. This is not an area I'm working on currently.
Okay.
The article Paul cited was from 2011.
Right.
I had to go back and read it to remind myself what I said.
Okay, great. Well, so Brian Riedel, though, you have done the math recently.
I have done the math. And first off, let me echo what Professor Diamond said, that with if you take the 70% federal rates and you add in Medicare taxes and state taxes, which are high as 10 and 11% in some states, you're really talking about an 85% marginal tax rate, which is, I think, far beyond what most economists would support. In terms of running the numbers, I went through the IRS data, and let's imagine we do what Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez said and apply a 70% income tax rate on all income over $10 million a year. The entire universe of currently untaxed salary income over $10 million is about $250 billion total. About $80 billion of that goes away from tax deductions, and half of it is capital gains, which is not subject to the regular income tax for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you're talking about a universe of $43 billion that is untaxed salary income over $10 million. A 70% rate would cover about half of the remaining untaxed money. So you're talking $20 billion a year, which sounds like a lot, but that would only close about 6% of the budget deficit. And the Green New Deal has been costed out by Jill Stein of the Green Party at $700 billion to $1 trillion per year. So raising $20 billion, and even that doesn't take into account tax avoidance or people shifting their income, you're looking at financing, you know, less than 5% of the spending. And so even if you could do this policy, and even if it did technically raise more money, there's just not that much wage and salary income over $10 million, because a lot of the people who make that much money don't cash it out as salary income. They
Right.
keep it as capital gains. They keep it as assets. We're talking pennies compared to the deficit and the spending proposals that we're hearing.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to you in a couple of minutes about the deficit issue here, but let me get a response from Peter Diamond. I mean, I guess what Brian is saying is that he doesn't even feel like it's worth it in terms of the revenue raising that could happen.
I would ask him a simple question. Is there some other tax he thinks would be a better start to raising more revenue, since he didn't disagree with my view that we need more revenue?
Ultimately, I think you're going to solve the long-term deficit problem, you likely are going to need some additional revenue in addition to significant spending restraint. As for other revenues out there, you know, broad-based policies could probably have smaller distortions on the economy. I'm not sure a 70% income would be, or 73% income tax would be very good for the economy. I think there's a lot of economic damage that has to be dealt with. I'm not saying it can't be on the table, but I'm saying look at what happened in France when they tried a 75% income tax, and it was a disaster, and it got repealed a couple of years later.
But Brian, can I just ask, so tell me specifically, though, what economic damage do you think would happen, theoretically, if these top tax rates were increased?
Well, I think what can happen is you at best for these individuals is they just shift money overseas. It doesn't get taxed. Money leaves the instead of staying and getting taxed, the money goes overseas and leaves the United States completely. Worst case scenario is people just stop investing. They stop expanding their business at a certain point. They stop being productive at a certain point, because if you're paying an 85% marginal tax rate, when you include Medicare and state taxes, you're simply going to slow down innovation. And if you move this tax down lower to lower incomes, you start to have long-term effects. You know, someone may not decide to go into a certain profession or a certain major or expand a certain business because the tax rate's going to be too high.
Mm. Well, let me get Peter Diamond's response to that, though, because Peter, I mean, what Brian just said is something that I think we very frequently hear. I mean, it's kind of almost an economics orthodoxy, saying that if you tax the super wealthy too much, you take the sort of velocity out of the economy. But there are economists out there, and I presume that you're one of them, who say, well, if we look back in time to when, you know, in decades past, when those top marginal rates were high, we didn't see that suppression of economic growth.
I think we want to start with, we have a list of things, and I've heard this list and others. You know, people won't pursue education because if they make huge amounts of money, then they'd be taxed heavily. I mean, some of this stuff strikes me as bizarre. But yes, there will be effects. There's no question about that. The two questions are, how big are the effects? And for that, there is no substitute for empirical work. Rolling up anecdotes won't do it. And the second thing is, you can't think about efficiency overall. Who are the people who are being hurt when you collect the taxes and there are some changes? Well, it gets spread around. If there's less demand for labor, that affects workers too. But the primary effects will be on the people who can afford it. Mm. And that's the critical element that's missing in this discussion when you start talking about the economy as a whole.
But can I just jump in here quickly? Because what Brian Riedel, one of the things he said was that these people, the folks who can't afford it, the super wealthy, are also, I mean, you know, I'm implying what you're saying here, Brian, but they're key to providing the means for investment that then have a positive effect on everyone else. And if you're taxing them too much, you're reducing their incentive to make those investments.
There are lots of sources of investment funds, and the idea that the central element is these people with huge amounts of money, I believe, is misplaced. I haven't seen detailed studies of the ability to raise money for innovation that gives them such a major role. They get a lot of newspaper coverage. But historically, we've had innovation for decades without having the same income inequality.
We'll talk more about this when we come back. We have to take a quick break. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the mathematical realities, the economic realities behind Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's call to increase the top marginal tax rates in this country for those folks earning $10 million or more to perhaps 70%. She said that this weekend on 60 Minutes when she was interviewed by Anderson Cooper. And here's a little bit more of what she said. She was talking about, Cooper asks her, basically, how are you going to pay for all the programs that you want to include in what's being largely called a Green New Deal?
How are you going to pay for all of this?
No one asks how we're going to pay for this Space Force. No one asked how we paid for a $2 trillion tax cut. We only ask how we pay for it on issues of housing, healthcare, and education. How do we pay for it? With the same exact mechanisms that we pay for military increases, for the space force for all of these ambitious policies.
That's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, the interview garnered a lot of response from different corners of Washington. Here's Louisiana Republican and House Minority Whip Steve Scalise, a vocal critic, saying basically that he totally disagrees with what Ocasio-Cortez is proposing. And he was on Fox and Friends yesterday.
I strongly disagree with this idea that you should just confiscate all the money or most of the money that people make and try to get into this class warfare debate. I said, look, let's have an economy that works for everybody. By the way, our tax rates, the fact that we cut taxes, is creating jobs. It's helping rebuild our middle class, those very hardworking families.
That's Congressman Steve Scalise. Brian Riedel, let me turn back to you here because there's something that Peter Diamond said before the break I wanted to get your thoughts on. Professor Diamond was basically talking about what we really need is empirical evidence of what might happen if we raise those top tax rates, and we don't yet have it. So I just wanted your response to that because we could theoretically talk about outcomes and possibilities, but do we really know exactly what would happen?
Well, I could say that we have had high tax rates in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and that was referred to earlier. Mm. People use that as an example, saying, well, 91% tax rates under Eisenhower didn't kill the economy. Well, that's because virtually nobody paid those tax rates because the thresholds were so high and there were so many loopholes. In 1960, only 8 taxpayers in the country actually paid the 91% rate. Overall, in the 50s, there were so many deductions, et cetera, that the top 1% actually paid lower tax rates on average in the 1950s than today, and tax revenues on the individual side were lower in the 1950s as a percentage of the economy than today. So we don't really have empirical evidence in America of how 70 and 80 and 90% tax rates would work.
Brian, let me just jump in here for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to respond to what you're saying right now, because you know I take your point about the diminishingly small number of people who paid that rate decades ago. But I'm seeing that if the United States did something now, we'd be talking about some 16,000 taxpayers out of 330 million Americans. And so also a small number in 2019 terms.
Well, it's a lot more. You're talking about a lot more economic investment affected, a lot more individuals affected. And let's face it, today it's a lot easier to move income away from being taxed. It's a lot easier to shift your wealth into capital gains. It's a lot easier to move money overseas. Let me give the example of Jeff Bezos. His net worth is $160 billion, but he only paid himself a salary of $80,000 last year. Rich people who make that much money can decide what form to have their compensation in, when to take it, and how to take it. They're not just going to leave the money sitting there in salary income to pay a 70 or 80% tax.
So, Brian Riedel, is this you? Is this the Manhattan Institute saying we should have an overall wealth tax and not just an income tax?
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that either. But I'm saying if you just in a vacuum, put a 70% federal marginal rate on salary income over $10 million, rich people aren't just going to sit there and take $20 million in salary in order to pay that tax.
Well, let me get Peter Diamond's response here.
I think you've raised a really important point, which is together with the increase in tax rates to get more revenue, we could be changing all sorts of other aspects of the tax structure. Capital gains are taxed too little relative to dividends and interest income. You got the deferral in there. We could make a whole bunch of other changes which would make the revenue more responsive to the rate, and we could go at it in a series of steps. We don't have to leap all the way at once. We could phase it in and watch what happens.
Hmm. Well, let's get some calls here because we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Once again, we're talking about this idea. It's just a proposal right now to what would happen if the United States raised the top marginal tax rate to 70% for folks earning over $10 million a year, what that could possibly pay for, how much revenue it would generate, if any meaningful amount at all, and maybe perhaps even fundamentally, if philosophically, it's the right thing to do to tax the super wealthy even more. I'm joined today by Peter Diamond. He's professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the 2010 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Brian Riedel also joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. And let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Daniel, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Magna.
Hi.
Why does the tax rate have to be a set number? Why can't it just float to be whatever the government needs it to be? And so if the ultra wealthy are going to use their money to lobby for legislation that ultimately they think would save them money, it costs them money and they'd have to pay for it.
All right, Daniel, thank you for your call. Peter Diamond, do you have a response to him?
I think there's a need for predictability of things. And the fact that we only learn slowly over time how much different things cost. So, yes, we do need periodic adjustments. We do need to try to line up the revenues and the expenditures. I don't mean exactly no deficits by any means, but the long-run trajectory of the investment that we want to do through the government and the financing of that and the other expenditures that aren't necessarily investment, we need to be adjusting the rate just as you've suggested. But I don't think it would be viable to make it automatic.
Mm. Brian Riedel, let's get your take on that.
Yeah, that sounds like a call for a balanced budget amendment in a way. A balanced budget amendment that would be more tax heavy than spending cut heavy. Such a policy can be pretty challenging in a recession when the deficit's going to automatically increase and then you're kind of taxing people even more.
Well, let's go to Maria, who's calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Maria, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that as a professional, as a woman, and as a Latina, I am deeply embarrassed to have Ocasio Cortez represent us. She is presenting extremely ignorant views. If she thinks socialism is such a hot idea, why doesn't she go and live in Venezuela and Cuba, where, by the way, people are fleeing on foot with nothing? That's what socialism does. If she thinks that's such a good idea and that's what she wants for the American people, why doesn't she go and live it for a year, 5 years, 10 years, and then come back and implement it? She knows what she's talking about. She has no business trying to destroy this country.
Okay, Maria, wait, don't go away. Let me just ask you a question, because, yes, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has embraced, she calls herself a democratic socialist, but sort of taking that language out for a second, what do you think of this actual idea that she's you know, given some altitude to? We're having this discussion about, is it plausible? Is it a good idea to raise tax rates on America's top earners? What do you think?
Is it possible? Of course it's possible. With liberals trying to run down this country, it's of course possible. Is it a good idea? No, it's not. As Brian was pointing out, if people stop getting rewards for their work and for their money, what do you think is going to happen? Who'd stick around to pay the government to fund all these programs that are not going to do anyone any good? Because the worst part of this is that the things she's trying to implement don't even make sense. Hmm. So who do you think, rich people are going to be taxed to death and stick around for it? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make social sense. It doesn't make sense.
Maria, thank you so much for your call. Peter Diamond, let me turn back to you here for a second, because there's something that Maria said that Brian Riedel also mentioned a little earlier, that in this day and age, high tax rates may not disincentivize the ultra wealthy from trying to earn as much as they can. But what we have in the modern global economy is the ability to expatriate your money more easily, or, you know, to be more to even yourself leave. And I mean, I think this is a significant difference from what we had a generation or two ago. And how important is that to recognize that if we're thinking about, you know, what would be the realities of raising the tax rates on America's top earners?
I think that there is a response. There's no question. And there are two points to make about it. One is mobility across different taxes is an issue we've had within the U.S. without the problem of leaving your home, leaving your family, leaving perhaps the language you grew up with. And the amount of mobility within the U.S. or recent study in Spain across regions with different tax rates, there's some of it there. It's not a big deal. Hmm. in terms of the moving around of money and hiding it, this is something where international cooperation can make a big change, because revenue needs are not a U.S.-only problem. And it's not easy to get organized around it, but it's on the table. And the particular tax havens that hide this money, these are often very small places where I'm not talking anything military or anything, but the kind of economic leverage
right.
U.S. and the EU could put in place. We're seeing right now a struggle between the EU and Ireland over whether their low taxes were unfair to everybody else.
Yeah. Brian Riedel, what do you think?
The challenge is, I think what Professor Diamond is envisioning is there's a lot of if we do this. You know, if we could raise their taxes high, they can easily move the money to capital gains. Okay, well, then let's raise capital gains rates through the roof, which, by the way, are also extremely tax sensitive because you can decide when to take capital gains. And then you can say they can use deductions. Well, let's close the deductions. They can move the money off seas. Let's create a better global system of making it difficult to move money overseas. There's a lot of ifs here that aren't a given. And I think there's a danger in putting in a policy that assumes that you're going to be able to do 20 or 30 other reforms in order to keep chasing this money that, frankly, I think just looking at it politically, is probably not going to happen. And so you end up being very disappointed in the results because it's just very hard to keep chasing this money. I don't think we can assume we'll be successful there.
Okay. So let's get down to a fundamental question that actually Peter Diamond brought to us at the beginning of this hour. And that is, you know, if there is agreement. And maybe I should just ask you, Brian, do you agree that perhaps that the United States does need to more significantly make major investments in, say, things like infrastructure? And if so, and taxes aren't the way to generate that revenue, what would you do?
Well, I think right now the big problem is if you take a look at the 30-year federal budget projection, according to CBO, we're going to run an $84 trillion budget deficit over the next 30 years. The source of that? The Social Security and Medicare systems are going to run a $100 trillion cash deficit, including interest, and the rest of the budget is going to run a $16 trillion surplus. So ultimately, if we want more money for infrastructure, if you want to invest more money in kids, more education, health research, which I agree completely have been starved over the past few years, you really have to get a handle on Social Security and Medicare, which I know is a third rail and people don't want to hear it, but that's ultimately what is driving us off the fiscal cliff, $100 trillion cash deficit if you count all general revenues that will have to be transferred into those programs, including interest over 30 years. I don't think we can keep taxing our way to pay for this. As a matter of fact, if you run the numbers, you would need about a 40% payroll tax or about a 50 or 60% value-added tax just to keep the budget relatively balanced over the next 30 years before you've even made the additional investment.
Mm.
Taxing the rich, it's mathematically impossible to pay for this by taxing the rich. So for the investments that we all agree, I would take a look at Social Security and Medicare, especially benefits for upper-income families.
Uh-huh.
You don't always have to tax upper-income families to death. Maybe make them pay more for Medicare or not get as generous Social Security. I don't think you can chase it all with taxes.
Peter Diamond, the third rail. There it is.
Okay. Let's focus on Social Security because that's something I've worked on much more than health care. Health care, we obviously have a massive problem of people who are outside Medicare, as well as a concern over, given all of the things that are happening in healthcare, how expensive they are and how important they are. That's a major problem. But let's talk about Social Security. Social Security, by law, doesn't borrow. So the numbers that Brian was just citing are numbers assuming the law gets changed and Social Security goes on paying benefits, which by law it can't pay. So what will happen, and given the forecast in 2034, what will happen in 2033, I suspect, is a lot of what was happened back in 1983 when Congress and the White House, led by President Reagan and Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill fixed Social Security with a mix of things. Mm. It recognized people are living longer, people can work longer. It did some benefit cuts. It did some revenue increases. The particular mix back then, I don't think was very well designed, but that's a complicated political outcome, which I could give you an hour on if you wanted. But going forward, yes. When we face that crisis in Social Security, I think we will do a mix of lower benefits than are in the law and a mix of higher revenues than are in the law. And I see nothing wrong with that. But turning it into a scare that we've got to have a massive cutback in Social Security is misguided. And the thought that you can just do it by lowering the benefits on the very high earners is, again, there isn't the full amount of money there.
All right. So you're relying on Washington to come up with some kind of solution for Social Security when they can no longer kick the can down the road?
Yes. It's too big a political outcome if everybody in the country gets a 20% benefit cut. That's not just the retirees. It's the disabled. It's their children. It's their younger spouses, the family money. Come on, 20% benefit cut for millions?
We are talking about, broadly speaking, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's provocative call to raise the top marginal income tax rates on folks earning $10 million or more to 70%. How much money, how much revenue that would raise, if it would be enough to pay for a Green New Deal, and what the economic consequences of such an idea might be. I'm joined today by Peter Diamond. He's a professor emeritus of economics at MIT, won the Nobel Prize in 2010. And Brian Riedel also joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the idea floated by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of raising the top marginal tax rates in this country to 70%. She'd like to do that in order to help fund what's being called a Green New Deal. Now, this idea received a lot of pushback from different corners of the United States. Here is former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, on CNBC yesterday. Here's what he thinks of the idea.
If you're willing to take a significant drop in economic activity, I would suggest that. I think it would be a terrible mistake.
That's Alan Greenspan. On the other hand, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary and Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro said he agrees with the proposal. He was on ABC's This Week on Sunday.
I can support folks at the top paying their fair share. As you know, George, there was a time in this country where the top marginal tax rate was over 90%. Even during Reagan's era in the 1980s, it was around 50%. So do I support, in order to have something like Medicare for All, that we ask folks that are in the top 0.05% or 0.5% or the top 1% to pay more? Yeah, I support that.
That's former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro. Want to know what you think? So let's go to the phones. And Jan is calling from Bellingham, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air.
Thank you. Actually, Castro just made one of my points. I grew up, I'm in my 70s. You know, there were high taxes with Eisenhower and Kennedy. And we look back at those years as a great growth of the middle class, of innovation, And so I'm not convinced by trickle-down economics. But my more important point is that if we don't deal with the climate crisis, and that's going to cost us a bunch of money, but if we don't deal with that, even these very wealthy, very innovative people who have started all these wonderful businesses will not be able to continue to do the things we're doing, because most people don't want to look at the fact that 50 years from now, even access to clean water is going to be a lot more limited than it is now. And I think we need to really figure out what we can do to address the climate problem. And if it costs a whole bunch of money, it's money well spent.
Right.
Because the other side of it, whatever your tax rate is and however wealthy the wealthy are, isn't going to make much difference.
Yeah. Well, Jan, thank you so much for your call. Brian Riedel with the Manhattan Institute, let me turn to you about that, because Jan does bring up a point that thus far our conversation here has been largely about what the straight-up costs would be in terms of the deficits, perhaps, that would be grown if those top tax rates were increased, or, you know, if a Green New Deal were created. But what Jan is saying, I think, is very important. What happens when we account for the cost of doing nothing, for example, or the potential economic benefit of restructuring the economy to be prepared for climate change? I mean, aren't those more complex factors ones that we need to be accounting for when talking about whether or not raising tax rates is a good idea?
We have a lot of economic challenges in this country. There's a lot of things that we want to spend money on and improve, but we have to be realistic right now. We're headed to a budget deficit under current policies that's heading to $2 trillion within the next 10 years. And it's going to go even further after. Like I said, we're going to have a national debt that's going to approach 200% of GDP within 30 years. That is a recipe for fiscal calamity. If something is worth doing, it's largely worth paying for. And with that, let me transition to the fact that what Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is proposing and other Democratic socialists are proposing, I add it up, and the cost is $52 trillion in new spending over 10 years on top of the $12 trillion budget deficit. So that's $64 trillion in costs. That would more than double the federal budget.
Is that when you're accounting for Medicare for All?
Yes. That's Medicare for All, government jobs guarantee, free college, infrastructure, paying down student loans, green jobs.
Because it's not clear to me that in their actual sort of Green New Deal proposal, at least in the write-up that I've seen recently for a select committee on coming up with a Green New Deal, that they would require Medicare for All to be part of that package.
Of course not. But here's the thing you notice. They recycle the same tax increases across all of these. They say, how are we going to pay for Medicare for All? Tax hikes on the rich. How are we going to pay for free college? Tax hikes on the rich. How are we going to pay for a Green New Deal? Tax hikes on the rich. You can't keep going to the same well. You can only raise tax rates to 70% one time.
Mm.
And so there's a certain incoherence here. And let me point out, too, that the Green New Deal is approximately, according to the left's own advocates, $700 billion to $1 trillion per year. And the 70% tax rate proposed by Congressman Ocasio-Cortez would raise at most $20 billion a year. So we're talking it would pay for 3% of her proposal. That's it, 3%. So I understand that we have a lot of priorities, and I agree with the caller that there's a lot of national priorities, but you can't just put everything on the nation's credit card and have deficits going
right
to $3-5 trillion a year.
Well, Peter Diamond, I'm going to get your response here to this in just a second, but I wanted to just play another little piece of tape from Ocasio-Cortez's interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday with Anderson Cooper, because, you know, he also pushed her on the fact that it seems her idea seems rather outlandish. And here's what she said.
What you are talking about, just big picture, is a radical agenda compared to the way politics is done right now.
Well, I think that it only has ever been radicals that have changed this country. Abraham Lincoln made the radical decision to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made the radical decision to embark on establishing programs like Social Security. That is radical.
Do you call yourself a radical?
Yeah, you know, if that's what radical means, call me a radical.
Peter Diamond, what do you say?
I think climate change, thanks to the caller, is a huge deal. Unlike the budget aspects, which Brian was just citing. Budget changes are made repeatedly. We go down a path that's too expensive, we can slow it down, we can reverse it. Climate change is a looming, massive problem that takes time to address, that will be disruptive in part to address, but new technologies are going to do wonders for it and have been happening. So I think addressing climate change is a huge deal, and what's important is to focus on what we should be doing with a bit less attention to some people have too long a list. And in particular, and this is something that I know a lot of conservatives, economists are in favor of, a carbon tax, which would generate a huge amount of revenue, most of which it's commonly proposed is used to hand out to people equally per capita to handle the increased costs they'll be living with. But some of it can be used for these factors. And whether we do or not, in terms of disastrous costs down the road, addressing climate change is right at the top of my list of things we need to do. I wonder what Brian thinks.
Yeah, Brian, go ahead.
Well, a carbon tax is definitely, something to look at. And when I put out a budget report a couple weeks ago on a 30-year plan to fix the budget, and I did take a look at a carbon tax, one of the challenges is, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the most common carbon tax would raise about $100 billion a year, except we're going to want to give rebates to the low-income families who are going to be paying a lot of it through higher energy costs. And so regardless of how it may help the environment, it certainly may be part of the solution. I'm not saying it won't. When we're talking about the budget aspect of whether or not it can pay for this clean initiative, the net revenue after the rebates, again, you're looking at maybe $15 billion a year, which is virtually nothing compared to $1 trillion a year. So I'm not arguing against the environmental aspect. I'm not even saying it's a bad policy. What I am saying is, it doesn't get us off the hook for having to pay for a lot of these big initiatives.
Would you take a further step and go beyond it's not a bad policy and say it's a good policy?
Not yet. I think that right now there are certain concerns that a carbon tax could have some negative economic effects that we have to look at. One thing that needs to be part of the solution, and that I think Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez has talked about, is we need a lot more investment in research on new technologies to help us, to basically come up with new ways to avoid overdoing carbon and improve the technology. I would focus a lot on that. I'm not ready to endorse a carbon tax, but I'm also not ready to say it's a terrible idea either.
Well, so Brian, let me follow up with that and just sort of ask you something that comes from, I don't know, maybe another radical corner of economic theory, because this morning I was reading up on modern monetary theory that might say that looking at these issues through a budgetary lens is the wrong idea entirely, right? I mean, for example, Stephanie Kelton, a professor at Stony Brook, I saw a quote from her that's saying if the deficit has to be, 5% of GDP to create the economy that we want with full employment, low inflation, poverty reduction, who cares?
I think this is an extraordinarily dangerous and misguided view, and I think 99% of the economists would tell you that as well. The viewpoint between modern monetary theory is essentially, if the government can print money, what's the problem? We can't go bankrupt. Well, there is a certain thing called hyperinflation, and when MMT theorists talk about allowing the debt to double, triple, quadruple, and almost entirely funded, essentially in a roundabout way through the printing press, economic history has not been kind to that approach when you look at hyperinflation. And MMT has become very popular on Twitter. I've learned a lot of new swear words on Twitter when I talk about people with it. But I think if you go down that road and you're wrong, your country's economy collapses if the MMT advocates are wrong.
I mean, in their ideal situation, though, they would say that the government could control for hyperinflation by scaling back on programs if the economy gets overheated. But Peter Diamond, your thoughts? I really am asking a fundamental question about the lens that we're looking at all these new ideas through.
Okay. First of all, I haven't read any of the MMT literature. I got a brief summary like the one we just heard from Brian, and I chose not to read it. But let's talk about deficit and debt. I think for some countries, their ability to finance their debt gets critical at some point, and interest rates start to rise because of a problem. It's particularly severe if your debt is in the currency of another country. Mm. At some point, if our debt was big enough, we would run into that problem. Fear of inflation or fear of non-payment are the same kinds of fears. Are we anywhere near that now? I think the answer to that is no. Right. Down the road, yes. So I think we need to consider also the difference between financing investment that enhances growth and financing other kinds of expenditures. We need some of those other kinds of expenditures too. But the PAYGO rule, for example, doesn't distinguish investment from consumption in a way that matters, because as soon as you start having better political rules for investment, it's amazing what will get labeled as investment. So it's not an easy way to address it. But I think right now, getting on with investment is much more important than worrying about the debt or the deficit.
Let's get two more, at least one or two more callers here before we run out of time. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought today?
I just wanted to call and say, generally, I'm a supporter of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's 70% top marginal tax rate proposal, but too often I feel like the debate gets centered on where, for example, Brian says, okay, this is going to raise so much money, that's not enough, let's not do it. Or the carbon tax will raise this amount, that's not enough to do anything, let's not do it. When clearly the answer is that we need a combined, nationwide, humongous strategy with a bold vision, where the wealthiest country with like so many resources and so much imagination, that we need to have a combined coming together with all of these ideas, because there's bound to be millions of ideas we haven't thought of yet. But it takes leadership that we don't currently have. Mm-hmm. And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represents what that next phase of leadership is going to be.
Right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. Let's get another view here from Ted, who's calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Ted, what do you think about Steve saying that he sees Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as providing the kind of leadership that at least is getting some big ideas on the table?
Yeah, I would disagree. I mean, I'm not an economist. I can't tell you whether this tax will be effective in that it creates the cost outweigh the benefits. But I think it's just undisciplined politics. It kind of scares people. It's not persuasive. It's politically unpopular, and it plays into the hands of Republicans who like to characterize Democrats as confiscating wealth rather than making investments in the future. So setting aside the economics, it's just bad politics. And worries me.
Mm. Well, Ted, thank you so much for your call. Brian Riedel, we've got about a minute or so left to go here. Just want to give you a chance to give us your last thought. I mean, if we are in agreement that investment is needed in the United States, and we've talked a little bit about where you think that money might come from, just, you know, what about the political situation, the political reality of getting sort of any new idea past the politics and policy phase and into, you know, the actual economy of the United States?
Well, this is my frustration working in Washington for 17 years is Washington chews up and spits out good ideas as well as bad ideas. And so the 70% tax, regardless of what you think of it, is going absolutely nowhere anytime soon. I will say in closing, too, that the 70% tax, again, would be an 85% marginal rate when you include Medicare and state taxes. And no person, no multimillionaire worth his salt is going to take their compensation and wage income in order to pay an 85% tax. So the amount of money this is going to raise is going to be close to zero. And I will add, even if you took every dollar earned by millionaires in America in a given year, that would raise about 3.5% of GDP. Still not even enough to pay for the Green New Deal. So the idea that if we just get a lot of smart people in a room and come up with a lot of good taxes, 100% tax rates, even if everybody kept working on millionaires, wouldn't even raise $1 trillion a year.
Well, Brian, I'm going to take it back from you because I want to give Peter Diamond. We've just got about 15 seconds left. Professor Diamond, what do you have to say? Your last thought.
I think it's important to be talking about a range of good ideas because the first reaction to many of them is negative. Where the line is between bold and radical, I'm not quite sure. One of them is supposed to be good, and in the eyes of some, but not all, the other is bad. I think it's good to have more things on the table.
Well, Peter Diamond is a professor emeritus at MIT. He won the 2010 Nobel Prize in Economics. Thank you so very much. And Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, thank you so much as well. And listeners, thank you as always. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.